Blog Talk. Hi everybody, welcome to the Blog Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I come to you live alternate Wednesdays at 9 p.m. I've got a really interesting episode tonight, March 23rd, called Couples in Business, What's Love Got to Do with It? Joining me as my guest is Everett Moitoza, a business psychologist and executive coach at Moitoza Consulting in Rye, New Hampshire. For over 25 years, Everett has consulted to and coached executives and advisors in family businesses, partnerships, professional service firms, and closely held small, medium-sized companies. You can reach Everett after the show at www.moitoza.com, and that's spelled M-O-I-T as in Tom, O-Z as in Zebra, A.com. Hi, Everett.
Good evening, Susan. How are you?
I'm glad. I'm happy. I'm so happy and excited to be here with you. I've really been looking forward to doing this show with you.
Oh, great. Me too.
Yeah. It's very funny because I was thinking in doing this show with you, I was thinking about how we met. And do you remember how we met?
Oh, my goodness. These are tough questions right off the bat. And forgetting you at the first time is almost unthinkable, but I don't remember.
Well, we were at a focus group together. Some very depressing subject, I think, about managed care or some horrible thing that was coming to New Hampshire. And you were the only other person in the room who had any spunk and laughter. And I said, I'm going to get to know that guy.
I do remember it was a hospital focus group. It was
yes.
For hospital care. Yeah.
That's right.
The hospital. Oh,
that's
sure.
Right. And then what I heard after the fact that you had had a history of, you were a psychologist, but you had a past life of singing jingles. I knew you were the guy.
Do that.
Yeah. Anyway, Everett, before we start talking, let me just share one brief technical issue for our callers. The toll-free call-in number is 877-497-9046. All callers will be muted, and we'll save questions to, I'd say, about the last 15 minutes. And for comments or questions, what you need to do is you raise your hand by dialing 1, and you'll be on the line to be on the air. So unless you have a question that you just cannot wait with, just raise your hand at any old time. But for the most part, it would be good for us to save them toward the end so we get through our subjects. Okay, so Everett, I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what you do and how you got to this work.
Sure. Well, I'm a family business consultant. And I consult with, as I think you said in the beginning part of the show, I consult with family businesses of multiple generations. And one subpart of that is working with couples in business, which are given the name copreneurial couples or copreneurs, like entrepreneurs, except copreneurs. So what we're going to focus on this evening is the copreneurial part, that is couples in business, who are significant others, so that it isn't they have a love interest, if you will. They may be married, and they most usually are, or they may also be married and then divorced, and still in business. so they mm-hmm. can come at it in different ways. And I've been doing it for about 25 years. I began it when I was teaching in Cambridge, and a student came up to me and said, I was teaching family therapy at the time, and the student came up and said, you know, my husband works with a family business, and I think you could be helpful. And I said, well, have him give me a call. And so he did, and I began working with a multi-generation family in Boston, and just fell in love with it, fell in love with the idea that I wasn't tied to a consulting room, and just enjoyed the people immensely. And then several years after that, I went back. I had a doctorate in psychology. I went back and got an MBA and began that sort of business side. So I do two parts of it. I do the business side and the relationship side, or the emotional side, which really is what families or couples in business are about. They're much more multifaceted than regular non-related partners. So that's what I do, and I've been doing it for a while. And excuse me. I just find it fascinating. What my goals are, people say, well, what do you do? What are you supposed to be doing with these folks? And I say, you know, I have three goals. With co-preneurial couples, it's couple harmony, individual well-being, and business prosperity. Those are the three targets that we always keep in mind, because those are the three pieces. You could put them almost like three donuts overlapping one another and say those are the parts that really do kind of intersect and interact. It's the emotional side that affects the business stuff, and it's the business stuff that affects the emotional side. And then there's that, you know, that rascal individual person themselves who brings their own psychology to the process and their own experiences.
Yeah, so, and I would think that managing that triad of goals is the hardest thing for couples. That it's probably, people could probably do very well in terms of running a business that's lucrative or doing well, but maintaining some kind of harmony and individual sense of well-being in the middle of it is much easier said than done.
Exactly. It's like what part is really going to suffer here? Which part is going to get short shrift? Is it going to be the person? Is it going to be the couple? Or is it going to be the business? I wanted to add also, in the beginning of the program, people say, well, you know, how many these co-preneurial couple things? How many of these things are there out there? And the last statistics I had is that they're somewhere around about between 750 and a million co-preneurial couples.
Really?
Yeah, that operate in this way. 750 couples, 750,000 couples who operate in this way. The numbers are hard to really nail down, but a conservative estimate would be 750,000.
Wow. And are there, it sounds like a lot of daring souls. I'm wondering, do they have statistics on how many of them don't end up getting divorced or ending up in my office because they're doing this?
How many don't end up getting divorced? Here's the good news, if not great news. If you use a standard divorce rate in America today at 50%, actually, I think it's getting a little bit lower. I think it's down to 47%. We're careening down to 47%. The co-preneurial couples actually divorce less frequently than do, you know, the standard, couple that has a dual career couple, where, you know, he might work someplace and she might work someplace else, or the single career couple, which is rarer and rarer in this country, but they divorce at a much lower rate. I'd hasten not to give specific statistics, but you're bumping over 60%, which is pretty significant. And people say, well, what, you know, why is that? Well, because there's another piece of glue, as well as there's another sort of danger and another complication and another stressor adding the couple, the business to the couple. There's also a kind of a balancing piece, just like you'd mentioned before, that triangle. Well, triangles, if they're three-legged stools, are ironically, they're quite stable structures. And so the business adds a piece to the couple that I think ultimately strengthens them. I've had a number of couples who were married in business who got divorced but stayed in the business because they could do fine as business partners, but the sort of the emotional or the you know, the affectional part, the marital part of the relationship, for different reasons, was really gone by and had a little left to do with it. So the business part adds, it's sort of a double-edged sword. It adds, it's a strength and it's a stressor at the same time.
Yeah, I would think it provides some of the same kind of similar kind of glue that the mutual goal of shared children provides
right.
for couples. It's very central, very engrossing, very challenging, can be lots of fun, hair-raising at times, but it forces couples into an awareness of, you know, we are working toward some very similar things, ideally.
Yeah, yes, exactly. There's something bigger than us.
Yeah.
There's something bigger than me. And it's this business or it's this kid. There's something bigger than us, that we're working on a bigger project.
Yeah.
You're right. It can be the child or it can be the business. And that actually can become a stressor, because if the couple is married and in business together first and then have children, it gets a little more difficult. It's like Junior needs to find room. They need to find room for Junior.
And
he or she has to kind of wheedle her way in, because there's already an older child. It's called the business.
Right, right. Yeah, I was going to ask you, it's very funny, if there is a particularly helpful sequence, the couple coupling first and then doing the business, or the other way around. I mean, you're talking about the sequence of when a child comes into the picture, but I guess I'm wondering what are the elements that are needed in order for this relationship to do well? And in terms of sequence, are there statistics about that? Who does better? Yeah. Which coming first?
Sure. You know, again, it's kind of like the sequence with children, which is, it's usually better if the couple has been together for a while, has formed its particular affections and connections, has, you know, worked out some of its idiosyncratic couple issues, you know, personality issues with one another and quirks and so forth, and then you have children, right? So it's sort of called nest building. It's the same with family, with couples, co-preneurial couples, that it's better if the relationship has come first and that the relationship is really solid and that it has the kind of solid skills that any, you know, marriage would need to have, which is, you know, good communicational skills, a sense of maturity, trust and truth within that couple and so forth, and a kind of a shakedown cruise of, you know, some amount of time, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, but some period of time, and then you put the business on top of that.
Well, I would think good business working together requires all the same skills that are required of a couple to do well in their partnership. Managing conflict, for example, feeling safe enough to bring things up, managing the timing, negotiating solutions in a way that's win-win. I would think that it's all the same skills. And if a couple starts a business, and I'm thinking of some of the couples I've worked with, where they get involved in the business, it's almost like having a baby before, you know, too soon. They get involved in the business before they've learned each other and they've learned how to make room for each other. It's disastrous.
Precisely, because the relationship doesn't have enough superstructure or infrastructure to be able to hold the weight of that child or that business.
Yeah.
And as a result, it begins stressed out without those basic building blocks. I mean, the communicational pieces, you know, as you say, it's absolutely critical. And within that communicational piece, particularly within co-preneurial couples, being able to manage conflict, being able to communicate conflict, to be able to do it without respectfully, to be able to do that in a way that is clearly empathic of the other individual and what they're looking for and what their particular view might be, and being able to come to, you know, pardon the cliche, but win-win situations Mm-hmm. And all of that really comes from starting it off, just as you would any good business plan for a couple, is starting it off with a shared vision, having an ability to articulate verbally or in writing a mission statement. What are we here for? What are we going to do? How are we going to do it? And a vision of what it looks like altogether. A good business plan is kind of like a good and a good co-preneurial family business plan or family plan or co-preneurial plan has those elements to them. Because the couple, at least in my experience, is, and this kind of goes with the territory, they're always on the brink of being swallowed up by the co-preneurial business, that is, of being swallowed up by the business, the marriage, or the relationship with their children, employees. I mean, you talked before about triangles, third parts of relationships. So here's, the husband in the couple, here's the wife in the couple, or the husband in the couple, or the wife, it's a gay or lesbian couple. And then there's the third part, which are the employees, which often can take the position of children and being triangled where the conflict gets essentially outsourced to other individuals. Good cop, bad cop, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so, they're managing lots and lots of things.
Right.
Simultaneously.
What I do is I take the, in looking at the complication factor of what they have to manage, essentially you take the number of people in the system, you add it together and square it, and that gives you a complication factor. So if you're, if you're a couple, you're 1 + 1 = 2, you square it, you have a complication of 4. But let's take a business with 10 people in it, relatively small business, and you add that together, 10 is 20, 20 squared is 400, complication factor with a 10-person business of 400.
That's hysterical. I never heard of that. And that's because that's the subjective experience of complication?
Right.
Or is there any actual mathematical basis for that?
Yes, it's called the Moitosa Co-preneurial Square Root Theory. I made it up, but I think it is true. You just take the number of people in the system, you add them together, you square it, and that gives you a complication. If you're a single individual, 1 + 1 = 2, 2 squared is 4. Okay, but you get married. Okay, so you marry another person. You're a 1, your complication factor of 1. You marry somebody, 1 + 1 = 2, 2 squared is 4. It's 4 times more complicated living with another person than it is living alone. Add 1 child to it, you got 3. 3 + 3 = 6, 6 squared, 36. You go, so a husband and wife go from a 4 to a 36 with 1 child.
Well, that's another way of looking at why things are so difficult,
That's right.
Now you've given it a name.
Well, and also it's what it feels like.
Yeah, exactly. Like. Yes.
So you can see where even very small companies, where, and I gave you an example of 10 employees, essentially, is a complication factor of 400. versus again that couple again, just the two of them, 1 + 1 = 2, 2 squared is 4. 4 to 400. So, I mean, those are the kind of stressors. Those are the kind of demands. So, as a result, for example. One of the things that these couples have to have are clear boundaries, well-differentiated roles. And boundaries, a good example, when I was in a co-preneurial couple, my wife and I were the founders with another psychologist of the Portsmouth Family Institute. It's a postgraduate training program for folks in family therapy. And the three of us founded it, and we all taught in that program. So, and it was very early in our careers. When our first son was born, there was a lot of things that were going on in the program. There's always business to do and so forth, aside from our own practices. And so we made a rule that if we wanted to talk business after hours at home, we'd have to get in the car and go down to the office, and we could have our meeting there. Which was about 3.5 miles away. It wasn't terribly far away. But that was the rule, that if we wanted to talk in that business way and had that boundary about home versus business, place and relationship, we had to demarcate it with that trip. We made the trip once. And I think it was so traumatic that we had to go to dinner afterwards. So So it helped to say, like, okay, is that really important? You know, it is the question of, okay, is this really an important issue, or is this is there another time that we could do this? So setting that boundary between work, home, again, always at risk of being swallowed up. And the roles piece is another place where I think.
Very difficult. For who assumes what role and how you make room for each other and you defer to each other.
Exactly. And often what happens, particularly in closely held companies, family businesses, co-preneurial couples, they just kind of evolves. And you look at the job descriptions and people wear many hats. So it's easy to lose that sense of, okay, so what am I? I'm not just the accountant. I'm not just the marketing person. I'm not just the salesperson. I'm not just the CEO. I have different things. But being able to articulate. So one of the things that I find myself doing in a lot of my work in either family or co-preneurial couples is, okay, we've got to have a job description. Let's have an idea of who it is, and folks writing down, you know, what it is they really do in their job, and that's their job description. Well, of course, one of the things that happens is when they write it, they go, jeepers, I didn't realize I did all these things. And what do we call a person who does all of this? It all provides a lot of sensitivity, one for the other, of, okay, what is your area? You know, how would I even know if I'm stepping on your toes if I'm not really sure and we haven't decided what those roles really are and how we structure this and what the process is for doing X, Y, or Z activity.
Right. I've worked with couples where those roles get decided kind of by default because maybe somebody's a little better with facts, with figures, and so they end up doing the books when that was never their idea about what they wanted to be in the company, or somebody's a little bit better with people, but it just kind of they fall into roles, and then 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the road, they find themselves doing things that they never felt like they really signed on to do, and now it's kind of locked into cement. So I would think part of the role division is some kind of, I don't know, yearly review. Are we doing what we're good at? Are we doing what we want to do? Are we making room for each other in a respectful way? Or is somebody getting the short end of the stick in this?
Right. Well, you know, and the classic line that I hear is, hey, job description. Hey, we each of us do whatever there is need to be done. Well, that becomes the response around, that's why we aren't clear about what it is that we really do. Because one of the things that happens then, of course, is like, how would you know then when you need to hire somebody else to take on that you actually have work for another person, whatever that particular activity might be. How would you know if somebody's not overwhelmed? Well, we just do whatever there needs to be done, and it kind of evolves. And that's the difference between a professionally run company and a more informally or casually run company. And I think, you know, not that we want to bow and scrape and revere the corporate model of process, procedure, structure, systems, and sectors, but we probably could borrow a page from having some clarity in those ways, knowing what the business plan is, having a strategic review every year, both organizationally and personnel wise, and looking at that mission, vision, and the values, and are we doing what we said we wanted to do, and are we doing it the way we want to do it together, and are we true and are we holding clear with our mutual vision? Because one of the things that co-preneurial couples are, at least in my experience, is they're incredibly creative. 95% of all business in most states in the country is family business or individuals
really?
Who are related to one another. People say, that can't be true. That can't be true. Well, it is true. Half of the domestic product, annual domestic product, gross domestic product, comes from family-run businesses or managed business. So it is true. In New Hampshire, it's around 95-97%. And you look in most states, it's in the 90th percentile.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about unusual businesses. we're talking about very usual businesses, and we're just talking about the, you know, the either service, the product business or the service business. You had mentioned at the outset one of the groups that I consult to often are professionals, and that can be doctors in practice with one another who are married, or lawyers in practice with one another who are married. And those, you know, other kinds of professional groups as well, and the idea that that this is a unusual phenomenon, copreneurs or copreneurial couples, is hardly so, and they do hold a lot of the same parts that standard partnerships hold, but ironically, partnerships of non-related partners. About 80% are gone after 5 years.
Really?
Yeah, so they have a striking staying power.
Staying power.
Yeah,
that's so
it
wild.
It goes to show, well, see, it goes to show, sleep with your partner and your business will last. You know?
Your business will last, but will your marriage last? Because I see it on the other end where the business may be doing fine, but the marriage is really suffering. Because mm-hmm. everybody's working 24/7, so nobody knows how to make any boundaries between work and play, and all the grunt work kind of defaults to one person who is usually less assertive or more of a pleaser. Mm-hmm. There's generally issues about you know, people looking over each other's shoulders about mm-hmm. why did you do this way, or why didn't you do that, or why did you let your brother in? Just so many problems, and I see so much unhappiness related to it. And it's interesting, I guess if I were to look at the stats, their businesses may be doing fine, but, you know, it's at a cost to the relationship. That's why we have somebody like you.
Right. Well, you know, there is a cost. I mean, because I mean, it's bad news. It's good news and bad news. The good news is the business is doing great. The bad news is the couple has no time for itself. They're stressed out of their minds, and they are exhausted most of the time and are eaten up. Again, as I said before, the couple is always at risk or on the brink of being swallowed up by the business, particularly
yeah.
if it's successful. I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier about the, you know, what happens within the couples and the conflict that occur. I mean, if you look at and partnerships and why do couples in businesses, copreneurial couples last and others at a higher rate, my idea is that as in good partnerships, you have skill, what we call complementarity. That is, that opposite skills of business partners make for stronger businesses.
Yeah.
So you have one partner is the financial person, and the other partner is, let's say, the marketing or the salesperson. Well, those two skills and those two temperaments, really, if you put them on a spectrum, they're in the opposite end of the spectrum. And so opposites attract. Opposites attract in couples. 95% of most couples walking the streets today are complementary. That is, they're more dissimilar than similar in terms of their temperaments and so forth. This is the old toothpaste tube thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one's good with money, one's a spendthrift kind of thing. But they're opposites, and opposites attract. Well, it's true then that complementarity in copreneurial couples, of course, is there. But again, with the extra glue of that marriage and that relationship and the affection and the romantic history and the sense of, if you will, of love of one another, and hopefully within that is a respect and a trust and a truth that exists between them and an energy that is greater than the sum of their parts. So you add that complementarity. But what happens with that complementarity 5, 6, 10 years down the road? Is that which brought them together in an opposite complementary way actually like the poles of a magnet? If you put them together, they repel. And
right.
They start to accentuate the differences and the negatives, and start to diminish the more positive pieces. And so those parts of the opposite connection within the couple starts to get greater and greater. And that's a very serious risk. And so partner A hates that part, that stingy part of partner B. Before they thought, isn't it great that they're so good with money and they're able to make a dollar, you know,
right,
stretch out. And similarly, you know, that, oh boy, he's such a hail fellow well met, and he really is able to promote our business in that marketing way. He becomes, I wish he'd stop with this damn phony business about being everybody's friend and always wanting to go out all the time.
Right.
And
it mirrors exactly what happens in marriage. You know, the thing that was so compelling in the beginning becomes a source of irritation or contempt later on. And part of the challenge is trying to help people kind of look at it. What was the glue about that in the beginning? What was it? You know, now it just feels like you're victimized by it, but what was it that was so alluring in the beginning? I'm wondering, do you, when you work with people, Everett, do you try to anticipate some of these unfoldings as the business and the relationship move forward?
Sure. Well, there's always an assessment part that I do initially, which includes particular psychometric measures, as well as measure that I developed called the Moitoza Family Business Inventory, which looks at the positive business skills of the business and management skills within the business, the strength of the family or the strength of the couple, and then the third section, which is how the couple and or the family and the business interact together. And so I come up with a three-section model looking at the strengths and weaknesses of those. I also do individual interviews with the people. Again, with the couple would be with either of those, and usually one or two significant managers within the business. And that goes to confidential interviews. And then there's a pretty substantial report that gets generated anywhere from 20 to 55 pages, which looks in very significant depth about what appeared to be, you know, some of the issues in the couples, the strengths and the weaknesses, the threats, some of the business practices that are at risk and are weak, and again, how those come together. So there, we start off with that part, and then so we have those already evidenced, and everybody agrees about those in our report meeting that happens after that gets all written up. We all sit down, and it's the couple, the two of them and myself, and we go over that in detail, and then we write a treatment, what you would call in clinical work, a treatment plan. We look at it as a consulting plan around what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, when we're going to do it. You know, what the goals are, and everybody signs on to that. So it's an eyes wide open process. And yes, I do walk in with some pre-zoomed expectations. Like number one, I'm not being asked to be there because the couple wants more grace in their relationship or business. That is, I'm usually called in because there's trouble. You know,
there's a bleed. Yeah.
That's right. There's a lesion, and I'm here to staunch the bleed, and there's conflict. Frankly, that's why I'm brought in, because there's conflict. That isn't 100% of the time, but it's 90% of the time. Some couples really have tremendous foresight, and they say, "Hey, here's where we are. We got a couple of kids who just finished their undergraduate degrees in business. We're thinking about bringing them into the business, or hey, you know, we're a $20 million company. We really see ourselves moving up to $40 million, and we want to, get an assessment of where we are and what we need to do next to develop the next phase. Or we need to see if our kids are really competent to come in, and if so, how do we do that?" That kind of stuff.
Okay.
Or the couple says, not unusually, "Well, you're being brought in because we've had some problems here. One of the members of the couple has had, if you will, an indiscretion with a staff member."
Mm-hmm.
and we're thinking about divorcing or one of us leaving the business. And that's not an unusual one.
Yeah, that is very complicated when somebody's boundaries have been squishy and now they've opened them up to somebody else who also has some kind of vested interest in the company. And I would think that makes it so much more complicated.
It does. And, I mean, and it's, you know, there obviously there are a sense of mistrust and hurt and pain and the company and all the employees and the business is rocked and is at risk. But, you know, the situation is not hopeless, and but it is complicated, and there does need to be an assessment about, okay, where do we go from here, and how do we manage this situation? How do we manage this kind of problem, and how do we, you know, also how do we explain or manage this out to the company, because it's a relatively small sized company. When I say small to medium size, I'm talking, you know, anywhere from $5 million in annual revenues to around $200 million is a 200 a medium sized company, $5 million a small sized company. So in that range, that's really what we're talking about. And these are, people say, "Wow, that doesn't seem like a small company to me." That seems pretty good size to me. But you know, just sort of in the sort of MBA model of how you'd look at businesses, they'd be in that kind of a range. But
relative to the giants.
Most of these corporeal companies, really, you know, if you just say, hey, where do they mostly lie? But I'd say, you know, they're somewhere between 10, probably 5 and 20 million.
Yeah. Now, if you were working with a couple, I'm thinking about some of the couples I've worked with who were currently in business together and kind of at a war about it. I'm thinking about some of the kinds of issues that come up. For instance, one partner has ADD. And they're in sort of a denial about their ADD, and they're the front person for a lot of the marketing, and the other person is on their case saying, you're very chaotic, you're undercutting our ability to get more business, or you're losing track of stuff, or maybe one partner has really squishy boundaries with family, and they allow family to come in an influential way that's inappropriate, or they're putting up with a bunch of bull from an employee, and they're not assertive enough. Are you likely to, when you make your assessment and you're working with a couple in business, are you likely to zero in on things like that and maybe have a one-on-one with that person and say, hey, you need meds. It's affecting your ability to follow through. Or you need to practice some assertiveness training. Would that be outside your role?
No, I mean, I don't do therapy with any of my business clients. If folks need therapy or if they need assessment, let's take your ADD thing, I'd refer them for an ADD evaluation. But yes, but that would come up in the assessment, and I might do, if you will, sort of a preclinical assessment. I mean, usually somebody like that, you can kind of tell sitting with them. Again, that's part of the value you get when you're working with me. I do have those clinical skills. That's not my contract with people, but I do have them, and I'm certainly not blind to that stuff. So yeah, those could be some of the kinds of issues. A lot of time it's making those, you know, when the couple are making, or an individual in the couple is making what I call a family first decision, when it really should be a business first decision, which is, okay, I want to hire Junior in the company at a vice presidential level. Junior's been in and out of drug rehab, you know, 6 or 7 times. He's had 2 attempts. He had a llama farm that he tanked a couple of times, and you know, and he's now looking to go on the NASCAR circuit. He'd like to get fronted about a couple hundred million for a NASCAR to do that. And we're thinking about doing that. That's a family first decision. That's using family values, which are, you know, it's an emotionally based decision when it really should be an objectively based decision. So when you see those kinds of, you call them squishy boundaries, and I would look at them as squishy values that, again, using the idea of being a parent or being a husband or being a wife, using the relational piece when I should be using the business piece to make to make the assessment. And the ADD thing, which I will say, you know, just sort of as a sidebar here, I am truly amazed, if not shocked, at how often I see very, very talented and successful entrepreneurs with ADD or ADHD, attention deficit with hyperactivity or attention deficit without hyperactivity, and or attention deficit with learning disabilities. I can't tell you how often I see that. And if you say, you know, okay, you pull a gun on me and say, give me a percentage on that, and I'd say that it borders somewhere around 30-40%.
Wow.
It's very prevalent. And, you know, I think it comes with the creative brain in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking as a clinical psychologist here, but it's often been my wonder about it is, where does that come from and how is that there and why are they here? And it does tend to be people who are incredibly successful who, you know, they may be dyslexic, they have attention deficit, but the things that they are able to attend to, and when they do, they're brilliant. They're absolute geniuses, either in marketing ways or product development ways, or they relationally they have that piece. But you know, oftentimes you find out, you know, they kind of didn't feel very successful in college if they finished at all. They shy away from writing, and they aren't very, they're kind of self-conscious about maybe even the way they speak, whatever not, but that they have tremendous ideas, and they oftentimes can be very motivating managers and leaders, but without the organizational piece, without mm-hmm. the structural piece, without the clarity piece and the predictability. They can be quite distracted at times and the like, but they are very successful business people, that they run extraordinarily successful businesses profitably. It's not just chance.
Yeah. So there's maybe something about the nature, you know, a kind of creative type thinking outside the box that may attract people like that.
That they had to come up with alternative ways to success.
Yes. Yeah.
That they weren't able to be successful in those traditional classroom places. So they,
right.
you know, they were able to do it that way. I did want to be able to say, and I know that there are questions that come up in a couple of minutes here. So hopefully we'll get a chance to go through. I wanted to go over, or at least list the characteristics of, you know, what couples who succeed in business together, what some of their attributes or
mm-hmm.
characteristics are. But you were going to say something else.
Well, no, I was going to ask you about whether you had any particular profiles or stories that come to mind about couples who do better. And then I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if we have several listeners. I also wanted to ask you about advice to anybody considering doing this, but. Why don't you start with the, you know, an example of who succeeds?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've kind of outlined some of these pieces, but I just kind of wanted to, again, codify them. And if anybody would like, a copy, the name of this program tonight, Copreneurial Couples, What's Love Got to Do With It, is actually taken from a paper that I wrote that was published in New Hampshire Business Review. And if anybody would like a copy of that, I'd be happy to email them one. They can simply email me. They get my email address on my website, and I'd be happy to email them a copy of it. And it has these characteristics in it as well. But essentially, we've talked about it. Exquisite communication around conflicts. The ability to, when you're in an argument or a disagreement, to be able to talk about it. A natural array of complementary skills. It's critical in a couple that opposites are there, because
mm-hmm.
There's so many skills that one has that you have to have to run a business. One person can't do it, wouldn't have all the skills. It's
right.
It's very, very rare. An idea between the couple of what the plan really is about, a real clear copreneurial business plan. What are we doing?
Yeah, what's our mission here? Yeah.
What's our mission? Where are we going? How are we going to get there? Who's going to do what? How much is it going to cost? And gosh, would we even know if we got there? How
right.
would we know if we got there?
Right.
So that's a piece. And real business skills. People have to have real business skills. And which ones they have individually doesn't matter, as long as together they cover the range in some ways of, you know, a market of management of people, organization, some level of finances, and how to be able to operate the thing. Time management skills they need to have. That certainly is around boundaries, and particularly if there are children in the family with the couple. A shared work ethic. I think that's another big piece. You know,
very, very important.
You're
yeah.
not working twice. You're not doing anything at all. I'm carrying
oh, yeah.
you know, that whole thing. So that shared work ethic and how they work. And with the shared work ethic, I'd say also a shared play ethic or recreation, leisure, and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Boundary management, we talked about that before.
So you're talking, you know, Everett, you're yeah. what percentage of the population do you think have a good part of these skills? You're talking about very highly evolved couples, very seasoned couples, very mature couples, very conscious couples. Because I'm thinking about the couples I work with, you know, I would say there are maybe a few of them who have a smattering of these skills, but very few of them are solid in a number of these areas.
That's true. But one of the things that happens is if you look at a developmental model, they don't have to have all of this right away in the front end before they, you know, go to the Small Business Association for their bank loan. Essentially, these are the things that are developed in these couples as well.
But yeah.
Nobody's going to have this from the get-go. But the ability to develop it and the ability to grow and the ability to learn, which is really about what good business people are. The one
right.
thing that's constant in successful businesses is the ability of the owners, the founders, if you will, of the business, to recognize the need for change, that the only thing that is constant is change, and to be able to be in front of that change, to be on the front leading edge of that change piece. So part of what happens for these couples is that they are open, they are growing, they're communicating, they're developing, and these skills become deeper and deeper as the business becomes, of course, more and more complex. And you can see as businesses grow, they usually add more employees.
Mm-hmm.
Enter in a complication factor, and you know we can kind of see what that you know what the equation looks like. So the ability to have all of this in the edge, it's not so. But those who stay, those who succeed, and success can be, you know, it still can be a mom and pop that runs an accounting firm,
mm-hmm.
or a two-person law firm, or used to be the corner store, but now it could be the corner software company,
right.
or something like that. Those parts have to be able to evolve and to grow within between the couple.
Right.
And
so you're working with couples to build in an awareness and an appreciation of the fact that they're on a kind of continuum of change, and they need to, it sounds like you through the inventory, you help people identify core skills and values and patterns, and help them become aware of the pieces that they're going to need to work on as they move forward if the relationship, business-wise and professionally and personally, is going to thrive.
Right, and one of the biggest, you had mentioned before, so story about, you know, so couples, I'll give you sort of an archetypical couple because I see it so often. One of them has an addiction, let's call it alcohol,
mm-hmm.
The ability for the couple and communication, the ability for the growth, the ability for the just even sometimes the cognitive clarity of the alcoholic, let's make him a drinker, that becomes a very, very serious and not infrequent. The addictions, whether it's a an alcohol addiction. It can be a sexual addiction. It can be a spending addiction. It can be a food addiction. It can be a gambling addiction. All five of those can occur, and sometimes multiples of those. We can actually stop one and the other one gets taken up. But where those addictions, essentially where the individual is trying to fill up in themselves something which they're not getting, either in the couple or in the business, and sometimes both, becomes a tremendous threat to the business.
Oh, sure. Well, it's interfering with the whole developmental timeline of growth. Growth and more awareness and honing of skills. It's just the way it does outside a business partnership. Now,
right.
Everett, I'm looking at the time. It's 9:48 and 9:50 actually. And I'm wondering, I know there's so much more we could talk about. I have so many kind of scenarios in my head from couples I've worked with. And but maybe we'll need to do another show about that. I'm wondering if we should open it up to some questions.
Sure.
Because we just have a few minutes left, and there may be some people on the line who have questions on their own. So why don't we do that? If you're on the call live and you'd like to ask a question, here's your big chance to talk to the Big Kahuna. And all you need to do is dial 1 to raise your hand. I will then see your little hand raised on my screen, and I will bring you on the air. So is there anybody who has a question? Just dial 1. We get some very, very shy types. Oh, wait a minute. Here we've got a question. Let me see. Here's somebody. Hello, caller. What's your name?
Hello, I'm Tom from Maine. I've been listening, and I noticed at one point you were talking about how after maybe 4, 5, or 6 years, people start having kind of negative feelings towards one another in business, become more critical. And my question, I guess, evolves around autonomy and how when a person, for instance, becomes married, they lose some autonomy, personal autonomy. They have a child, they lose some personal autonomy. And then they have a business, a child, and a marriage, and where goes any personal autonomy? And how would this affect a business or a relationship in a negative way if that person needs some form of autonomy, which I'm sure most people do? And I'm just curious about how each of you have seen anything like this happen and perceive its effects.
Sure, that's a great question. It is true that we have to move over. We have to move over if we're coupling with our spouse or our spouse equivalent. When we have children, we have to kind of move over for them, particularly between the hours of 2 and 4 a.m. has been my experience.
Everett?
When they, yes?
Uh-oh.
What?
I think we lost Everett.
No, I'm here.
Are you
Hello?
There, caller?
I am.
Everett is there.
I'm here.
Yeah,
Susan,
Everett
maybe
is
you're
there.
Not
caller?
Here. Yep, the caller's here.
Hello? I don't know if this is
Both
just me or
me.
What.
Everett
I think
is here.
Oh, Everett? I'm not on the line. Something's happened on my end. Hello?
Okay. I'm here. So should we keep talking, Tom?
Can you guys hear me?
I can hear you.
Sure, we should. We can keep talking.
Okay, she'll keep asking. So I think it's
Oh, can
true
you
that
hear?
You
I can hear you now. Something must have happened with my mic.
Okay, I was answering Tom's question that as we couple, we have to move over. When we have children, we have to move over. And it's true, one of the things that we have to kind of move over for in terms of our personal desires or indulgences is when we have our business as well. But what we don't want to be is a slave to any of those. We don't want to be a slave to our business. We don't want to be a slave to our partner. We don't want to be a slave to our children, for sure. So, and that's the place, and that's where the challenge, if you will, of balance, of being able to developmentally start to ascertain, okay, how much do I need to put here? How much do I need to put there? And, hey, what about me? Because I'm the common denominator here. So the common denominator, if you'll let me be weird with numbers, it has got to be a whole number. It can't be a fraction number. It's got to be a whole number. In the new math, it has to be a whole number. And what that whole number looks like, has to be enough. But it is less in terms of its own self-service than it was before the child, before the spouse, and before the business. It's just part of what happens when you divide a person into those three things. It's a very good question, but that's the challenge of balance. And that's where coaching can be very helpful. And that's where, there's some really good self-help books on that. So I look for those kinds of resources. Counseling can be helpful in that way as well.
I've seen it in my work where people feel like they've lost themselves. They've lost individual prerogative and everything kind of gets subsumed by the business and by the other partner, and there's often a grieving. So I think if people were to focus more religiously on the three-part goals of harmony, individual well-being, and the business prosperity, and keep in mind that three-legged stool, I think in their everyday actions, a lot of people in business together would do so much better.
Right, and that individual well-being is as important as those other two.
Absolutely,
and you have to advocate for that. Martyrs need not apply; victims not employed. And that's what people go to oftentimes. Oh, I have no time. It's like, I have short patience. But I say, that's baloney. You have time. There's 168 hours in a week. And you can find some time here to balance this for yourself. Don't the victim stuff or the I'm working too hard stuff. That Puritan ethic doesn't play very long in my show.
Yeah. Good. Because it's just toxic. That's really all it is.
Right.
Well, I'm looking at. I don't know if we have time for any other questions. It's 9:55. Is there anything else briefly you wanted to cover, Everett, before we close?
I did. I just want to remind folks, when you think of the, some of the, entrepreneurial business, the first ones in the country were farmers and the husband and wife farmers. Oldest one in the country is in New Hampshire here, Tuttle's Farm. Just wanted to give them a shout out in Dover, New Hampshire. But other couples, if you think in business, the ones that made it and didn't, and let me just name a few for the older audience here, perhaps Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, George Burns and Gracie Allen, Ozzie and Harriet Nelson, Sonny and Cher. If you look at those couples together, essentially you see, two that stayed together, which are the Nelsons and Burns and Allen. And two that didn't, Sonny and Cher and Lucy and Desi. And if you look at those relationships of those two people, what happened to those two that didn't stay together? They essentially became single acts, very successful.
Yeah.
Desi off with Desi Lou Productions, of course, and who was nothing short of a genius as a Hollywood producer. Lucy, of course, as a comedian and actress. Look at Sonny and Cher, same deal. Sonny goes off and becomes involved in the entertainment industry and ultimately in politics, and she becomes an individual star. A sad example would have been Ike and Tina Turner, where there was other things going on in that couple, but they were a couple in business. So when you look at these show couples, these entertainment business couples, you kind of get a sense of the kinds of stresses and difficulties. And the ones that make it and the ones that don't. And the ones that make it, everybody kind of loves. Everyone kind of has a warm place in their hearts for them and see them in those ways. So that's the final thing that I think of.
Well, Everett, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. And you were great as always. I always learn a lot from you. And thank God for you. Otherwise, my couples would kill each other. So I, and thanks to all you listeners for tuning in. I hope everybody enjoyed the show. It went so quickly. I can't believe we're done already. Everett, it's been fun. It's never boring talking to you. For anyone wanting to explore this issue or solve some problem related to it, if you're thinking about going into business together and you're in couple, you're a couple, you can contact Everett at www.moitoza.com. Is that right, Everett?
Yes, the email address on there, it's actually moitoza@comcast.net is the email, but they really instruct people to go to the website because there's some information there and they get a chance to see what I look like and see some sort of a range of what happened. Susan, it's been an absolute pleasure. I always love talking to you. And
you too.
I'm glad that you reminded us of when we met.
I know. Well, thanks so much. Thanks so much, Everett. I'm going to have to sign off now.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Tune in to my next show Wednesday, April 6th at 9 p.m. It's called Tune Up and Oil Change, Keeping Couples Healthy with Sergio Parada, a popular and revered couples therapist in the north of Boston area. It should be lots of fun. I want to thank you all for joining, and I'll be back in a few weeks, and hopefully it'll be as fun as it was tonight. See you soon.